I came to understand the imperative, but also the very natural idea of toggling my thinking between human concerns and concerns of and for the greater than human world. Not tapping into that knowledge in a cultivating, connected, celebratory manner has robbed U.S. culture of all of these possibilities of expansion and positive production, etc. The writing of that process helps other people to see that their doubts and difficulties are real and valid, and to continue forward.
Hello, and welcome to Campus Conversations, the podcast, where we have in-depth conversations with the people who are working to address our planet's most pressing issues. I'm your host, Joni Mahoney, president of the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, and we are so excited to welcome today's guest. Camille Dungy is an award-winning author and editor who has worked tirelessly to expand literature and environmental studies. She is a university distinguished professor in the English department at Colorado State University. And Camille is also ESF's 2024 honorary degree recipient. And as a fun fact to get us started, I will tell you, reiterating what my co-host for today, Tyler Dorholt, told me, and that is that every ESF course that uses an environmental literary component has been influenced by your work. So thank you very much. This student body at ESF is really excited that we are going to be honoring you at our commencement.
I am incredibly honored and touched by this. So I'm excited to be with you all.
Well, thank you. And thanks for taking time with us ahead of time so we can get to know a little bit more about you as a person. And I'm very interested in what it was like to grow up that led you to this path, which is unusual for folks to grow up and be authorities in nature and the environment, and then to add to it the component of literature and poetry. So what was it about your upbringing that helped mold you in this career?
Is this the age old, is it nature or nurture question? I think in my case, it's both. I grew up in the American West. I was born in Denver, but I moved to Southern California when I was just a toddler. It's useful because I'm back in Colorado, and Colorado has justified opinions about people who move to the state from California, but I get to claim Colorado born status when I return. But the places where I've lived have always existed inside really dynamic ecotones, where the house I grew up in Irvine, California, quite literally, you would walk out the front door and you would be in a very manicured, human-built community of planned housing, et cetera, terraced hillsides to make room for human needs. But our backyard backed onto a hillside that had not been tampered with. And so my backyard opened up onto the wild, onto this really relatively untouched, greater than human landscape. And so my childhood, it was natural for me to see both of those possibilities within a matter of moments in any given day. And so I came to understand the imperative of, but also the very natural idea of toggling my thinking between human concerns and concerns of and for the greater than human world. And as I moved around the country, I think I was always seeking those spaces of deep connection with a wild wonder, and also knowing that my essentially suburban ideas and comforts could, in some ways, with careful planning, coexist with that kind of experience. So my writing just sometimes goes out my front door and sometimes out out that back door of my childhood experience.
That is a wonderful setting. And I'm joined here by Tyler Dorholt, who most people at ESF know. But Tyler, will you take a minute to introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, happy to be here. So I direct the writing program here at ESF, and I also oversee the Digital Storytelling Studio, which is the space that helps produce these podcasts and is a wonderful immersive space for students, faculty, and staff to come and learn the tools of digital storytelling, to have our gear to go out into the field with and make films about the wonderful science that is being done here. But I'm also very much a humanities background fellow and a poet and a writer. And I'm consistently fascinated with how much work you have done to curate other people's work and to put together a framework and an entry point. And I think that that's a gift that often gets overlooked, because not only do we work toward not potentially pigeonholing themes or writers, but how do we allow these larger surfaces and entry points? And I'm wondering if you might be able to speak a little bit about how, ever since you began doing editorial work, what ways does it affect how you read and how you take in art and the world? Do you have to turn off a curatorial button in the mind sometimes, or how does that play into your genre production as well?
That's a really interesting question. I do think that I have to turn off that curatorial mind. It might be one reason why I find myself jumping from project to project, because if I start to read and work through the world too much in a transactional manner, where I'm just reading for content to fill whatever editorial project that I'm doing, I can eventually lose the pleasure of reading to just find work I like. And so then I jump to the next project so that I can return to that more innocent joy of discovering new things. But I will always jump into a new project so that I can do that, because I do think it's one of the most important things to me about being a literary citizen and a citizen of the world, of not, maybe it's part of this idea of not keeping your light under a bushel, which is one of my takeaways from my religious training, that if you have a gift, you have to share it, that that's part of the responsibility of having a gift. And one of my gifts is seeing communities and worlds that are underrepresented. And by their being underrepresented, the culture loses out on not just beauty, but also solutions, possibilities, answers, ways of being and seeing and understanding the world that will help us to survive and to thrive. And so whenever I stumble on communities with which I'm connected and I have some way of helping to broaden the reception and attention that those communities can get for their very good work, I then feel this desire, responsibility, and joy with finding ways to share those.
You know, I haven't thought about it in probably 45 years, but I had that same message year after year in elementary school about, if you have a talent, if you have a gift, you have a responsibility, you're really living that. And it goes always. When you have what you talked about, underrepresented voices and the culture that isn't participating in this broader conversation, everybody's missing out on that. It's not just the people for whom that story is real. It's for everybody that needs to hear from each other. I think I read a quote of yours that it isn't a conversation if all the voices aren't there. It's a monologue.
Yes.
That really resonates with me. And it's not one-sided. It's all-sided. Everybody benefits from hearing from everybody else. And I think you're defining precisely the role you're playing in that, facilitating the voices that, you know, the rest of the world isn't hearing, but for the work that you're doing.
Right. I mean, I think it would be worthwhile to give some names and to labels to what we're talking about. And essentially, it is racist exclusionary ideology that has for some time caused a predominantly white literary community to assume that Black writers aren't saying important or interesting things about the environment and how to live and how to survive in the greater human world. And that's just folly, obviously, because the entire reason that the Black people were forcibly transported to this continent had a lot to do with expertise that Black people had in raising crops like indigo and cotton and sugar, the labor, et cetera, and then all of the that comes from that. But where I want to go with this really is not within the victim paradigm of the Black population, but to really just say that not tapping into that knowledge in a cultivating, connected, celebratory manner has robbed US culture of all of these possibilities of expansion and positive production, et cetera, right? So every time energy is spent on silencing and marginalizing a group, that energy could be put in a whole different direction and the possibilities for connection open up so many more avenues than any kind of silencing ever will.
I couldn't agree more. We have the benefit here at ESF of having a prominent platform for Indigenous voices. We have the Center for Native Peoples and the Environment, and that message is true with the Indigenous community as well. And we've seen the benefit, not just to ESF, but to the broader community, the deliberate attempt to welcome the voices from the Indigenous community to the benefit of everybody. That's what I meant by always. You know, we miss out if we don't hear about that traditional ecological knowledge. And as you're pointing out, the expertise of a huge segment of our population that has a relationship with the land and can share that in this environmental space. And so you find these writers and you've compiled and edited anthologies to highlight some of these authors.
In 2009, I published an anthology called Black Nature, Four Centuries of African American Nature Poetry. And it remains the only anthology of that size to highlight the long tradition of environmentally engaged poetry in the African American community, going all the way back to Phyllis Wheatley, who was the first Black poet in the English language to publish a book of poetry. So it's not like some sort of new concept. What has been joyful over the years that Black Nature has been in the world are the number of writers who tell me that they're allowing themselves or understanding themselves to be writing environmentally engaged work that they didn't realize that as Black writers or writers of color, that that was allowed or available to them. And so when I published Black Nature, I can count on my hands the six poets who aren't in the original version of Black Nature because I couldn't get rights for their work, right? That, and there's six that I can count on my hand that I'm really bummed aren't in the work for that reason. Now, if I were to do a new edition, I would be leaving out a whole lot more writers because there's just so many more people who are writing with this kind of environmental engagement, because how can we not, right? How can we not in this moment have questions about climate, habitat, species loss somewhere in our minds? And so these questions are really directly at the forefront of so much of our literature, not just environmental literature anymore. So that's been exciting to be part of a community of editors and scholars who have helped to make environmental writing mainstream, not some sort of niche that only certain kind of granola eating people. I'm laughing because I have my jar, my like reused jelly jar of granola sitting right here next to me as I say this. So I am in fact a crunchy granola kind of person, but it used to be that that was only like, that was some sort of sideline community. And so I'm just happy that the work that I did was part of this expansion, and that in that expansion, then more voices of people of color could be just right there, front and center.
And that is exactly what Tyler's been doing, and the other members of the writing department here at ESF is taking that and sharing it with class after class after class of students. So I'd be interested, Tyler, for you to talk about the reaction that your students have when they're introduced to Black nature.
Well, specifically, just embracing and teaching these books is another mode of inclusion that was absent in many academic settings. And students here, a handful of them have a minor in environmental writing, and one of the courses they take is a survey of environmental literature. And that particular, I always teach Black nature. What's wonderful about the reactions that have come from the exploration of Black nature is that students here are really interested in what kind of policies and actions can come out of the things that they're reading and engaging with. So everyone was tasked in one of these classes to present a poet that they found some kinship with in the anthology and explore the biography of that, but also talk about how the issues that are within the poems could be discussed in a larger framework with the communities we're a part of here. So we have been for 2.5 years running an environmental storytelling series, which we work through different themes in the community, and we do one event downtown and one back up on campus, and we have different artists and storytellers kind of come through these spaces. So Vivi Francis was here to talk about the anti-pastoral, and you know, so I'm kind of interested to add on to this that students' reactions have just been profound, and they've sought these poets and these anthologies out, and they've gone after reading more. What are the ways in which you see potential links between the emotions and the sense of ownership we take over what we read and how that gets us into the community engaging with those things? You write about some of this in Soil too, but do you see that there's a lot of work to be done between the links between how we read and understand the world and how we bring our reactions back out?
That's a great and complex question. And I do think that it's been at the center of my, I guess my ethic, you know, of how and why I do this. The Black Nature Anthology is purposely not just chronological or alphabetical, but broken into 10 cycles that you can read a cycle just as itself, or you could read the whole book. And that's largely about storytelling and connection for me, because if I made it chronological and started with that poem from 1770s, you know, I would lose a fair number of readers because it's a little hard to directly engage with work that are outside your idiom. So I mixed up the timelines so that you could fall into a poem from the 19th century and then come into something that feels really current, and then back and forth and move around and feel those connections. My last name is Dungy, and I will readily admit that if I get an anthology that's alphabetical, I will read through my section, maybe through the E's just for parody's sake. And then I put the thing down and I never pick it up again. So if your last name starts with Z or even M, I may not get there because I don't make it. So I want to that kind of accident not to happen. And I wanted you to be able to read each of the cycles of Black nature and get a story, get some kind of idea about how this environmentally engaged writing connected with a particular theme might manifest, and walk away with a kind of knowledge. Storytelling is a fundamental mode of communication. Our whole idea of why humans are better than and different than any of the other life forms on this planet almost always revolves around language and tool use. And if language isn't a tool, I don't know what. So it's tool use, and language is this tool for communication that we understand. And then if that's going to be what I'm using, if that's the tool I'm using, I want to engage, and I want to make connection. And I want to make connection that can lead to action. That action may just be going and finding more writers or more from that writer that you're interested in, but it may be the kind of action that comes from a different kind of understanding, and you think more about planetary care, more about what neighborliness might mean, more about any of the number of kind of things that environmentally engaged writers talk about, because for many of us, meaning doesn't come just through data and figures and numbers. It comes through a story that connects with our heart. And through our heart, we get to our mind.
Listening to the way you're describing how language is a tool. So we have too many examples to count of the environmental injustices that have been borne disproportionately by communities of color. And that is true here in Syracuse, New York. And your teaching, your writing, your anthologies strike me as such a gift to people to say, I have a role in this. I have a voice in this, and this isn't just something that's going to happen to my community. I can be an active participant, and that connection to the heart through the stories is going to prompt the action that is necessary, especially in these frontline communities. So I'm happy to hear that our writing department is not only teaching Black nature, but putting it in action with these visits out in the community and making sure that a broader audience than just our students is aware of your work and aware of the voice that everybody can have in this conversation. So it's such important work, and I'm grateful that you're doing it and really surprised there isn't more of this work that's been done. There's not more people collecting these poems and these stories. And I think have started rolling a snowball down the hill that will get bigger and bigger. And as you said, if you were to do a new edition right now, it would be much bigger. But when I think about being out in the community and I look at where the most harm has come from environmental decisions that people have made. And then to just think about these young people not seeing themselves in the story, but for what you're doing. Do you get out into the community and have these opportunities to hear from people who've been moved by your work?
Yes, I do. So my new book, Soil, The Story of a Black Mother's Garden, really, I think a lot about the ongoing impact of that legacy of separation and silencing and siloing, and the ways that even for me, even for me, who we've just spent all of this time talking about really my entire literary career. My first book was published in 2006, and then Black Nature in 2009. And so my whole career has been writing with this kind of connection. And I still, in the process of writing Soil, beginning in a focused manner in the year 2020, had to remind myself that I had a place in the environmental canon, because so much of the traditional foundational environmental canon that I was raised reading was so white and so male and so about solitude and being in some sort of pristine, isolated place, that the idea of being a Black mother writing about seeking a connection to the wild, wonderful world while being in shutdown with my fourth grader in my suburban house, like, it just didn't feel like, is this really nature writing? Is this really environmental writing? Or am I just like faking my way into it? And so if that's the case for me, why wouldn't it be that way for people who, for many, many, many aspects of their identity, have been actively excluded from the canon of environmental writing? And so these kinds of moves that we make towards extending an embrace towards other ways of being human in the world, in the world of environmental writing, are as important as the moves that the art world makes towards reaching out towards artisans and weavers and people who make blankets or do those kinds of other things that were called crafts or artisans, but not art, right? All of these kinds of manifestations of broadening imagination that I can participate in, even if it means reliving birthing pains myself, to really trust that right to be showing up in this space in this way, I'm all for it. And I'm all for modeling how difficult it is. So in Soil, I don't just write that I'm doing it. I write the process of how it is difficult and why it is difficult to show up in the world in these ways. And I think the writing of that process helps other people to see that their doubts and difficulties are real and valid, and to continue forward.
It wasn't just that these folks that you just described as white and male and solo, right? It wasn't just that they formed sort of this club about who gets to write about the environment, but they defined what it was for all the rest of us. This is what environmental writing is. These are the perspectives that matter. And they kind of defined it in a way that excluded a lot of us. And you're knocking that down at its foundation and saying, that's part of it, but you're missing a big part of it if you're excluding people for whom that wasn't the experience, but nature and the environment is a huge part of their existence and of all of our existences. And I don't think this is the only area where that has happened, that the people that got there first kind of you know, made all the rules and defined the parameters for all the rest of us. And I just love this example that you're just kicking that door open and saying, fine, you have your value and your perspective, and we will read what you have to say. But not all of us can go out and sit in Yosemite for weeks on end in order to be inspired to write about the environment.
And it shouldn't be that way. We're not going to make any kind of truly functional change if the only way that you can believe that you've had some connection to the greater than human world is to like go sit in it by yourself, because most of the human population doesn't have that luxury. So we really have to figure out.
You're going to exclude all the mothers.
Yeah. I mean, and like, just like people who live in high density areas, which probably more of us should be living in high density areas because of the human population. We cannot all have massive acreage. That just won't work. And so those kinds of, you know, it's just by necessity, I think we have to really reframe this conversation. And also such a small percentage of the human population speaking for
the rest of us.
Yeah.
I agree.
I'm so happy to hear you talk about process. I gave a workshop panel a couple of weeks ago on process as storytelling. And the ways in which I think about it, I think, come into play when I'm navigating or reconciling, is this part of my day a poem? Is this part of my day a paragraph? Is this part of my day something that needs to be fictionalized? And I'm curious as to how you have allowed for genre to either collage itself, to be a collaborative thing, or if there have been moments where those things have hard separations for you, and especially, you know, in Relative Strangers, when you know that you want to embrace and write about that which is right in front of you, your children, or becoming a part of the world with and alongside others, and more toward how you find that space to say like, nope, I'm sticking with this part of the writing today.
Thanks for nodding to Guidebook to Relative Strangers, because there's an essay in that book that might point to this, that I was trying to write. I was trying to write an essay about getting to be a book tour. I published a bunch of books and anthologies right in the same little pocket of time when I was also trying to be up for tenure. And so I had to promote these books. I had to do that, but I also had just had a child. And so I was traveling all over the country on book tour she was 9 months old when I started this, and going as far as traveling from the San Francisco Bay Area to Fort Kent, Maine, which is the northeasternmost point in the continental US, and with a 9 month old. And it was crazy. Wow. And everybody thought that I was crazy. And I was trying to write this essay that was kind of a logbook story about what was going on with that and why I was having to do it, the economic imperatives and the professional and creative imperatives. And I also was for some reason just obsessed with, because I'm fascinated by history and how our history always intersects with our presence. But I was really, in this case, fascinated by California Bay Area history and all of these stories of people who were sort of trying to make it, trying to succeed and make their lives and their dreams successful. And some of them did, and some of them just catastrophically just did not work out. And the stories were all around me and I couldn't stop thinking about them. And I was trying to create this. I didn't know what it was. Was it going to be a poem? Was it a braided essay? And then one day I was out for a walk with the baby and walked on one of those placards that you build into the sidewalk that'll tell you something about something. And I was like, oh, right. History is always right under our feet. And we just carry on our lives. And then the structure of the essay became clear. And it's just an essay with all the story of the traveling with the baby and the present day. And then all of those Bay Area history stories are footnotes underneath the essay. And that only worked in print. It doesn't work online. Like the form really becomes part of the function for me. I think that's where the artist in me comes out, that I'm always trying to communicate. I'm trying to use the tools of language and technologies of a book or any other kinds of ways that I'm sharing the work. And sometimes a poem is the answer, is the way to do it. Sometimes an essay with like jazz hands, like that one that I just described. Sometimes in the case of Soil, I also included photograms and photographic images because I know that so many of us are visual now, and that if I didn't include enough of a guide for you to really see what you were looking at, you would just go to Google and then I would lose you forever. And so I knew that I needed to include images in the book to meet you where you were going to be, so you could trust that you could see some of these things. And it just comes to me, I think, Tyler, in the process of, I mean, I make it sound easy, but it comes to me in the process of working towards trying to find the best way to communicate these big feelings and ideas.
That's great. And I mean, in that the working toward is just, it is forever and it's footsteps, right? It's the embodiment of that. And I think with your work and with a lot of what I'm trying to work on, it's fighting against the linearity of time and the false linearity of history. And so it's so nice to hear that footnote essay as a way to look at that. And so grateful for your work in that space.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we are going to be welcoming you to our campus, and you will be getting an honorary degree. It was quite the extensive process for us to go through as part of the Big State University of New York system, and they gave us their blessing, and we were very excited about that, and we're happy that you can join us. And then I think you'll have a few minutes to say what you would like and address our students, most of whom will be familiar with your work, because all of our students take writing and these instructors have been teaching your work.
I am so excited to be there. I already wrote my comments, because you are an inclusive community. You need it for the translators and the captioning. So I am actually always delighted when somebody tells me that they need the work early for that reason. I was just so tickled by this invitation in general, and really specifically this institution.
Well said. So I will leave you on that note and wish you well in your travels across country. And we will look forward to seeing you in person. Tyler, I think you're going to be part of the group that will...
Yes, hanging out, giving you a tour on Saturday and spending time to dinner with some other writers.
I just want to say one last thing, and that is that I had the benefit of being at Tyler's department meeting when they made the announcement that you were going to be the honorary degree recipient. And to a person, it was big smiles and enthusiasm, and I knew we had somebody special. So looking forward to seeing you, and I really appreciate you taking time ahead so that we can get to know a little bit more about you.
Thank you so much, Joni. Thank you, Tyler. And I will see you on the weekend.